This is Mark Strassman, reporter with Utopia Media's Entertainment Technology World. We're about to speak to Bob Gordon, who's the Vice President of Production at Fox Animation. Welcome to Utopia Media's Entertainment Technology World.
Well, hi. How you doing?
Good. Could you situate for our listeners Fox Animation within the context of News Corp and other Fox production facilities?
Well, sure. News Corp is, of course, the parent company of 20th Century Fox, and we're a division of 20th Century Fox.
Okay.
Blue Sky is the studio that does our digital animation. They're located in New York, and they are owned by News Corp, but not directly owned by 20th Century Fox. So it's kind of a close relationship that we work with them, and it's really in New York where the product's made.
And they can work for other companies outside of News Corp.
No, they're wholly owned.
They only work for Fox Animation.
Blue Sky works just for Fox Animation, and we're related companies.
Okay, well, could you just briefly go over what your responsibilities are there as VP of production? What are you responsible for?
Well, as Vice President of Production, I work with the producers on the films at Blue Sky and other films that we do here for Fox, all theatrical releases, feature films, basically, and make sure that the production's running smoothly, provide support when needed, and an extra set of hands when necessary to get a production finished.
Okay. Talk about the origins of robots.
Well, I think robots began a long time ago with an idea that Chris Wedge had for creating this story. Worked with some writers to develop the initial idea, and Bill Joyce and our production designer joined Chris on the project, and they began to look at the world of technology in different ages. You know, the steam age, which we represent by our character Gasket, who has this big billowy smoke coming out of her head. If you would, the 40s, Rodney himself modeled after an old Evinrude motor.
Right.
And then on into the modern technical age of tungsten, where you see some of our characters like Big Weld and Ratchet and Cappy, they're very much, chrome and shiny. So, that perspective of the technology that Bill Joyce brought to the project, Chris brought, we began to envision this world and the characters in it. And then, the story began to shape itself around, the idea of how these different characters interact with each other, good ones and bad ones in each area. And we wanted to tell a story that was a human story, something about, the idea that you still can in this world achieve greatness without necessarily being born into it. And that's kind of where Rodney comes in. He's sort of the Horatio Alger, if you want, the American dream, the dishwasher son who, not necessarily given the best start in the world, but nevertheless, manages to achieve and make a difference.
So there's a lot of things going on here, historically and conceptually, as well as in terms of the animation.
Absolutely. Like I said, we really tried to bring in a lot of different aspects into the movie, and there's really a rich tapestry there when people, look at it. I mean, not only is it visually beautiful and with many layers, but we're trying to layer in a lot of different themes. When we wanted to, like I said, we wanted to conceive a robot world. We didn't want it to just be shiny and chrome, as so many people often do. They're necessarily entirely dated in kind of a, if you want, kind of a Flash Gordon comic book world. We wanted to envision a more historically accurate technology. If you really do look at our characters, I think you'll see some of them that seem to be patterned more after the 19th century vision of an industrial society that runs on steam and
right.
smoke and coal, on up to the very, very modern.
All right. When did the writers get attached to the project, and what did they do with what was already there that you've just talked about and shape it into the script?
Well, the project itself has a long history that probably dates back close to 4 to 5 years, and different writers worked on it. The first writing passes probably began about 4 years ago when we came up with sort of a basic idea for a story. Then that was transformed here over the last 2.5 years, particularly when Gans and Mandel came in and began to, flesh out the story to give our characters more depth, to create real personalities for them, and really to create a dialogue that seemed real and interesting.
Now, they've written together before, but not for animation, is that right?
That's right. This is the first time they wrote for animation, and I really think they had a good time doing it. Because the wonderful thing about animation is you're not restricted so much to physical reality.
Did you talk to them much or at all about how it was different for them to write for animation as, instead of live action?
Well, I talked to them a lot, and we never really got into that conversation, but we did get into just the idea of, you know, how much they seem to be enjoying these characters.
Okay. Now, and it's a little hard, I guess, to say when you, quote, started production, there were milestones along the way. Was there a time when, now, were any non-digital technologies used in doing this, or was this all computer-generated? Or how was the animation done?
Well, the animation is all computer-generated. Everything that you see on the screen is generated within a computer. It's all virtual reality,
right.
3D.
Right.
But in any animated project, and my roots go back to traditional animation, it all begins the same. Whether it's a 3D film or it's a traditional film, it starts the same. It starts in storyboard, where you begin to lay out 2D drawings of your characters. It begins in 2D design, where designers begin to look at not only the characters, but the environments that the characters are going to work in. And, that all sort of then is put together. That all goes to a modeling department, where the characters and the environments, you know, get transformed from a 2D world on paper into a 3D world in clay, where some of our modelers work, they like that tactile sense of,
right.
of working with clay, and they form maquettes of Rodney, of Cappy, of Piper, of our different characters to help inform our digital artists who will then, create computerized models of these characters. They do the same with the sets. We actually built a small physical set so that the director could look at the set and the artist could look at the set and get a real three-dimensional feel for it before it was put into the computer. Same thing happens with the story. The story is first fleshed out on storyboards. And, we've all seen those on the old Wonderful World of Disney shows where it's just like a comic book,
right.
where you're looking at each drawing. And during that process, the basics of the story begin to be worked out, who the characters are, how they interact. From story, it goes into layout, and in layout, you really then kind of create the imagery and how the story is going to be told. Shots are selected, whether or not there's cutaways, the pacing of the film is laid out, the movement of the characters through the sets. And up till now, it's very much like making a 2D traditional animated cartoon. The only difference is in layout, you make a transition from the 2D world of paper into the 3D world of computer models.
Right.
And at that stage, then everything becomes in the computer, everything becomes completely, if you would, electronic.
Right.
The riggers come in and they set up all the controls that are necessary to make the characters move, the props move, the backgrounds move, if there's any movement in the background. And then once all that's ready and assembled, it goes off to the animators who, keyframe by keyframe, create the 144,000 images that you need to make a film.
Okay. Would you say that you needed to also develop new technologies to do this, or at this point are those technologies well enough developed that you could essentially take them off the shelf either from your own company or from others and just work on the process of production?
The technologies that we needed, for the most part, were there.
Right.
And we do try to use a lot of, if you would, open software that anybody could buy on the market.
Right.
Programs like Maya.
Right.
But we have our own unique proprietary rendering software that we
right.
call CGI Studio.
Right.
And it's unique from whatever anybody else has because it's a ray tracing software.
Right.
So
tell us what ray tracing is.
Ray tracing is a little bit hard to explain.
Okay.
I'll do the best I can.
Okay.
What we do, and remember it's all done in a computer, is we actually project a virtual ray into the digital scene that's been created.
Okay.
When the ray itself, it's all mathematical
right.
at this point, intersects with an object,
right.
it then calculates, the computer software, I guess, calculates the properties of that object.
Right.
Whether it's transparent, whether it's reflective, whether or not it casts a shadow.
Right.
And then what the software does is it returns a pixel.
Right.
And that pixel gives you the intensity, the color, and basically creates the image plane that is the picture. So what we're doing with ray tracing is we're actually coming as close as you can with a mathematical model of how real light works.
Right.
So we're able to play light off of different textures, the intersection of different textures, and I think we, you know, create what's visually a very stunning world that in some ways feels more real.
Right. So in that sense, you can be photorealistic or beyond.
We can be. We can truly be photorealistic. And just a question of how many rays we, you know, want to bounce. And that's the one control we have.
Right. And that essentially becomes a question of computing power, cycles, and money and time then, right?
Absolutely. We do one sheet, and that is, right, in nature, the light source is external. It bounces off the object and comes to our eyes.
Right.
We go backwards, and that is that we know where the eyes are of the viewer,
right,
and we shoot the rays out of what would be the eye,
right,
and watch how the rays would reflect off of the objects.
Okay.
So we're not, you know, flooding the entire digital world with light and only collecting,
right,
what would be seen. We're following a backward path, if you would.
Right.
But what we get is a very realistic simulation of how light really does play off of these materials. And I think if you look at the film, you can see in the, you know, some of the liquids that we have,
right,
you know, the tremendous transparency that we've been able to create, wonderful shadows with, you know, high detail in them. And maybe the thing we're the most proud of is just in this film, when you get into the shiny metals and those objects, just the reflections that the software creates there.
Okay. Was there a specific decision made before you started production or at a certain point in the production about whether you were going to create a digital master and make the film available in a digital cinema format?
I know we really never talked about it, but Ice Age was shown digitally.
Right.
So I think the plan was always that we knew we could. I mean, the first thing we do, after we're done, before we go to film, we have a digital master. The whole,
right,
thing, of course, exists on a digital file.
Right. Before it goes to film, for a traditional legacy projection, it's all in a digital master before it gets to the film that gets reproduced and distributed.
Exactly. And it's from that digital master that we will make the videotapes,
right,
the film,
right,
or in the case of what we're going to do Monday night, just simply project it.
So in fact, it's not as it would be if, say, we wanted to digitally project Casablanca and we take the film and scan it and digitize it and convert it to digital cinema format. In this case, the film version of this is really nowhere in this process. You went from the digital master that you created pre-film and use that as the source for the digital cinema master for the digital projection process.
Exactly.
Right? Okay.
For us, film isn't the medium on which we record,
right,
the images.
Right.
Film's just in the media that we display it on, just,
right,
like you display it on videotape, or,
right,
you might put it onto a CD.
Right, and rushing ahead here, in an era when all films are projected digitally, there wouldn't even be any film in the process.
There probably wouldn't be.
Okay. Yeah,
the one curious thing about film is that because you're going into that analog world of film,
right,
we spend time, maybe more than people realize, looking at different film stocks, just as a traditional live-action director of photography would choose different film stocks on which to shoot,
right,
depending upon the scene he was shooting.
Right.
And a film crew might carry 4 to 6 different stocks with them at any given time.
Right.
We'll go out, and based on what film we're going to make, knowing whether it's going to be an organic world or whether it's going to be a metallic world, we'll look at film stocks, and we'll try to say, okay, when we transition this from the digital to the analog world of film, you know, what film stock do we want to use? We know it's not going to be 100% the same, but we can influence that look. So just as an artist might take, you know, a canvas versus paper, what is it, linen?
Right.
You know, we can make similar kinds of distinctive choices in the film stock we choose. So we do spend time in that process early on, examining film stocks and making a very artistic decision about, okay, when people see it in a traditional cinema, they're going to see it on this film stock, which has these certain characteristics of grain, of how it deals with, does it favor reds, does it favor greens, how does it work in the shadows, is it, what are its properties?
But in fact, all of that doesn't come into play when you're going to project it as digital cinema.
Exactly. When you're projecting as digital cinema, then you don't make those decisions at all.
Okay. So, and in fact, then, you're saying there was an assumption this was going to be exhibited digitally, but you really didn't have to do anything special to do that because you were going to be working from the digital master.
Exactly.
Okay. Talk a little bit, if you want to, about the Digital Cinema Initiative and its standards and how that influences what you do when you set out to create a digital cinema formatted product.
You know, I can't speak too much to that.
Okay.
I'm not going to try to ignore the question.
Right.
I'm not going to talk about something where, you know, I'm not sure I have the expertise.
Oh, okay.
I will say, you know, that, you know, for us, you know, we're making a film that's the director's vision.
Right.
In terms of his color choices, his artistic choices, his lighting choices. And so, you know, we don't really take any real standard into consideration other than, you know, is it going to be Academy aperture or is it going to be wide angle?
Right.
You know, and decisions like that.
Okay. I read in some one of the press materials that the film is also being prepared for IMAX using IMAX DMR, the digital remastering technology.
That's right. In fact, we actually had a day-and-date release with IMAX. So the film's out there right now in IMAX if anybody wants to go see it.
And how does that relate to the to putting it into digital cinema format? If it does, or is that IMAX is just another film stock?
IMAX,
in
exactly. It's not. It's very much similar to the film out process, where we take the digital files and transfer them onto film.
Right.
And with IMAX, all we're doing is we're changing the aperture because we did our film in 1.85.
Right.
IMAX, you know, normally isn't a 1.85 aperture. I want to say it's like a 1.33. But to accommodate us, they came very close to the 1.85. But because the film stock itself is bigger,
right,
part of that filming out process is their DMR process, where they, you know, basically electronically
right,
allow the picture to fill that frame, if you would.
So it's kind of a very advanced pan and scan kind of technology at this point.
Pretty much. Or basically, it's a film out process,
right,
not unlike what eFilm did when they filmed our files out to 35 millimeter.
Okay. If we can talk a little bit about the finances of this, was there, if you want to, if you don't, if it's all proprietary, don't, just tell me, the reformatting or the formatting of the digital master into the digital cinema format, how much did that incrementally cost? And you could relate to that in the context of whether you're expecting to get that money back by exhibiting the film in general release or in general digital cinema release, or did you just do it as a proof of concept?
I think we just did it because we felt we needed to. It's something that, you know, is part of what Fox is about. We're an innovative company. We
right.
want to be on the cutting edge. We work and partner with people like Lucas, who, you know, was one of the pioneers of this idea. And,
right.
So I think it's just something we feel we need to do. I don't think we ever made a financial decision or took into consideration.
Okay.
You know, like many distributors, we want to see more theaters equip themselves this way so people can
right.
see these films.
Okay. Talk about the Entertainment Technology Center at USC and why you decided to do a screening through them.
Well, you know, we think they're promoting this whole concept, and we're really kind of behind them. We have a mutual goal here, which is to give the audience, the viewer sitting in that chair, the most realistic and most honest representation of what the film director and the filmmakers intended that they would see. And when push comes to shove, at the end, whatever we can do in film, it's never going to be as clear, as precise, as sharp, and as true to the vision as when you project it digitally.
Okay. And give as many details as you want about this screening, and starting with who's invited and where it's going to be, and so on.
Well, you know, I don't really
know too much about that.
I can't speak too much to that.
It's on April 4th.
It's on April 4th.
And it's 7:30, I guess.
7:30.
Yeah.
I think people should start arriving at 7.
Okay.
And you know, it's being put on by the USC Digital Project. And,
right.
You know, it's on Hollywood Boulevard. And anybody that could get there should get there, because it's going to be awesome.
Okay. What's your part in the evening going to be?
Well, you know, I'm going to watch the movie and enjoy it with everybody else. And
right.
then at the end, I'll be there to answer any questions anybody might have about, you know, how we make the film, how, you know, our process for making these kind of movies, and just, you know, be available for, you know, talking.
Okay. What are your plans, if any, that you know of now that you can talk about to roll out the digital cinema version of Robots in any of the, what so far I've understand to be 80 digital cinema ready theaters in the United States and about 120 in the European Union?
Well, you know, I think that we're going to just you know, partner with anybody and have it out there as much as we can. I don't think we're, you know, I don't have any real, I can't talk about the marketing plans.
Right.
But we definitely intend to get it out there for people to see.
So other, so people who are or in cities where there are digital cinema-ready theaters might be able to see it.
Well, that's our hope. Like I said, we did it with Ice Age, and we had a very strong response. And again, Ice Age was a movie that was made digitally, so we were able to show it.
Right.
And, you know, to the extent that we can get it out there and to the extent that there's theaters that, you know, are equipped that way, we're going to try to put it in those theaters.
Okay. Could you, do you have a view about the 2K versus 4K? It's sort of a controversy, I guess, the issue of, is this is going to be in 2K, I assume.
Yeah, basically.
Do you have any thoughts on whether, on either the technology or the business side of whether 2K or 4K is better or more likely to be rolled out sooner or whatever?
You know, it's almost like, you know, it's a hard question.
Right.
Because you almost get into real, it feels like it's a religious issue almost.
Okay. All right. So we
I think each person has a view and a perspective.
Right.
You know, at the end of the day, you know, you know, the film is rendered at a certain resolution.
Right.
We render ours at about 822 by, I think it's like 1460 or something like that.
Right.
Which isn't exactly quite 2K, but then we res it up.
Right.
To make it work.
Right.
And all the quality and all the images there, and I think everybody that's there Monday night will see that. So I think, you know, there's different ways of getting to where you want to be. The end product for me is just, you know, to get the clearest representation of what the filmmaker's trying to achieve.
Right.
And if he chooses, you know, 2K or 4K or whatever or however it's going to go, I think that's what ultimately is going to drive it.
Okay. Do you have anything that you want to say about Fox's position about how the transition to digital cinema is going to be financed?
Well, I think the only thing we're looking for is we're hoping that the theater owners, you know, when the public embraces this and wants this technology for films like ours and
right.
films like being produced by Lucas and Zemeckis and everybody else that's getting behind it,
right?
I think just demand will drive it, as is always, you know, everything that's come about in cinema.
Is this part of that effort, or do you have a marketing plan or a general strategy in mind about how to excite the public to demand from the exhibitors to ask the studios to start giving them more digital cinema?
Well, I think from my perspective, from what we're doing, just making the very best movies we can and getting venues like this where we can show them,
right?
You know, is how we're going to get people excited. Because I think once people see movies like this, especially
right.
movies that were made digitally and didn't go through some, like you said, transition process.
Right.
Where it was moved from film to digitally, where it was pure digitally to begin with.
Right.
I think the experience itself will stand up, and people will just start demanding it.
Okay. Do you have any current timetable in mind about how the process is going to roll out and when more digital cinema might be out there and when, if at all, the entire production of Hollywood will be mainly viewed in digital cinema format?
You know, that's a guessing game.
Okay.
You know, I think right now you're in a stage where you have some early adopters of technology, which
right.
you have in any technology.
Right.
And those people that are kind of pioneering it right now, brave enough to take the chance.
Right.
You know, we'll get it out there. I think the public interest will grow. And I, you know, from what I know about technology, when you get about 30% of the theaters out there are digital,
right.
then the rest will just come in a flood.
Okay.
All right. How long it's going to take us to get there is going to be an awful lot of economic issues that are more complex than I can speak to.
Okay. Maybe you could speak to this. To what extent is it important that this offers a theater-only viewing experience? Because there's such a outpouring now of home theater technology options to give people almost theater-quality experience, except, of course, for the crowd. At home, how important is digital cinema, do you think, as something that's only available in theaters and that will therefore be more attractive to audiences?
Well, I mean, As somebody who's always loved the movies, I think there's something special about being in a movie theater that
right.
you can't duplicate at home.
Right.
Whether you're watching an old black and white movie or whether you're watching the latest, you know, digital release.
Right.
And I think there's always going to be that desire for people to go to the movies and get a really special and unique experience, something that they can't get at home. The size of the image
right.
makes it a whole different world. It puts you in a different place than you're ever going to be in your home. Not to, you know, denigrate home theaters or say that people won't watch these movies at home, but I think that the more that movie theaters can offer a unique experience, visually, audio experience, the experience of being there with other people, I think it's going to continue to attract people into those theaters. And, you know, over the years we've had gimmicks that have, you know, tried to get people into the theaters, but at the end of the day, the theaters that succeed and the ones that I think that people go to are quality sound, quality image, you know, quality just experience of the movie. And just as I think Lucas showed with, you know, Skywalker sound and, you know, the whole, you know, what he has achieved in improving the sound quality in theaters,
right.
you know, the digital projection will take that same step into a visual world. And people will say, you know what, I do want to see a movie with the best sound. I do want to see a movie with the best seats. I do want to see a movie that's absolutely got the most pristine image up there. I don't want to see frames that were cut out because the projectionist had to cut it. I don't want to be distracted by scratch lines on a film that's, you know, now a month old in the theater. I want something that's clean, crisp, clear, sharp. I want to see it the way the filmmaker wanted me to see it.
We haven't talked about that, but the idea of scratches, you can't get digital scratches. Say something about that and how important it is that the 300th or the 3,000th exhibition of a digital film is going to be visually equivalent to the first one.
Well, that's absolutely true. And, you know, that as an analog film goes through a projector time and time again, there's a certain amount of degradation that happens to it. It can get scratched, it can get nicked, frames may actually have to be, you know, cut out and spliced away. You know, we've all seen kind of a strange jump that we know the director never
right.
intended when he was in the editing room.
Right.
Sound quality itself can be diminished. The other thing that happens, I hate to say it's about theaters, but, you know, there's a certain luminosity of that bulb that's in that projector that,
right.
you know, has to be just right to get the images the director intended it.
Right.
I mean, we spend months at the end of post-production looking at the film, you know, through projectors that, you know, every day are set. We know they're the right. This is how we want the film to look. But then it goes into a theater, and you know what? Maybe the bulb's a little weak. Maybe the bulb's a little too bright. Things just aren't quite right. When you're in a digital world and you're getting digital projection, you don't have those worries. You're getting to see it exactly the way the director intended it, the way all the filmmakers wanted you to see it.
So what it eventually comes down to is high fidelity to the director's intention.
Exactly. It's like the difference between listening to an old 78 recording, which, you know, may be great and sound great, but you still have the clicks, the scratches, and you know the fidelity's not there, or listen to something that's your latest CD.
Right.
Where you don't have to contend with all the diminishing of the quality of the product that happens.
All right. I want to thank you for that paean to digital technology, as well as for answering all these questions. And I'm going to be there on April 4th, and maybe we can talk a little bit about the audience reaction, sort of follow up after that.
Absolutely. I'd love to.
And see how people view this digital cinema experience.
I think if people see it, they're going to demand it.
Okay. Thank you very much for talking to us on Utopia Media's Entertainment Technology World.
Well, thank you very much for having me on.
You're welcome.
Bye-bye.
Bye.